नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। I was thinking how for many Westerners, the introduction to Buddhism comes through meditation retreats. My introduction didn't come that way. I did my first meditation retreat, Goenka style, when in my 5th year as a monk. So my perception of retreats, it's no big deal. Yet I notice in Western culture, like, sometimes Buddhism is all around retreats, and the rest of life is a kind of treading water until another retreat comes. My own entry into it was more for a lifestyle which was geared to enlightenment. And so meditation, mindfulness was something I was encouraged to do in all postures, all activities, but we were certainly encouraged to do a lot of formal practice, and we did a lot of formal practice. So quite easily, we do 4 or 5 hours a day. So it was a lot of formal practice. But the idea of like you're going to do a retreat now, never really entered into my mind. This is kind of you're always trying to be more mindful, trying to understand yourself in different contexts of whether you're doing formal practice or you're. Once a monk is engaging in work in the monastery or going on alms round or whatever. So it was a more kind of seamless idea. But I do find in the West that like there's a sort of heightened sense of importance around a retreat. And this is really, really important, and kind of the excitement and so on. And it is extraordinary that we can sit together like this quietly. And that we can do this, so it is important. I don't want to dismiss it, but anyway, that's where I come from. It's my training, my conditioning. I was thinking how, we come into Buddhism through a sort of portal, maybe initial portal, and then we maybe define Buddhism that way. So our friends from Sri Lanka come into it from a faith devotional. Dana, kind of cultural entry into that. So their conditioning is from that portal, and my conditioning is from my way and yours, and so on. So we come to it from different perspectives, but I think we all love it because I think basically because it works. To me, that seems to be the litmus test of this doing that we're involved in, and that it does work. Certainly works for me, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. It's something I reiterate constantly in when I talk about Dhamma, is that we look at the Buddhist teachings from two perspectives, and one we call conventional truth, and the other liberating truth. Samutisaccha, vimutisaccha. And conventional truth is where we, in Buddhism, we employ the sense of I. And so, I am Viradhammo, and my kuti's across the stream, and I have a computer in the office, and I have to phone the architect on Monday, even though it's a retreat, and I need to get a passport, and I'm 66 years old, and my knees hurt. And things like that, right? So that's where we employ the sense of self, or the language of self. That's where when we talk about like responsibility, social responsibility. So I am a senior monk. I have responsibility to the community. Within that context, we talk about other issues. Maybe talk about. Environmental issues, maybe, or our views on politics and so on. So that's what we call conventional reality or conventional truth. And that's important. And so the teachings in that area are teachings around morality, generosity, sensitivity, communication, responsible social action, living up to one's commitments, and making sure your bank balance stays balanced, and you can pay for the mortgage, and you take the right kind of anti-cholesterol pills, and so on. And that's conventional truth. And so the emphasis there is living a life of generosity and moral impeccability. And that's one of the ways that when we think about the Buddha's teaching, where Buddha often says, I teach suffering and the end of suffering, one of the ways that we abandon the attitudes and perspectives of suffering is by living a good life, living a life of generosity and sensitivity to other forms of life, to our own bodies, to taking care of ourselves and our families. And that's a kind of altruistic selflessness. We give up our selfish tendency to maybe dominate others or hurt others or just be mean-spirited and try to get as much as we can for ourselves and not worry about anyone else. I remember when the first year at Wat Nanachat, Thailand, Ajahn Sumedho was still, I think he was still really a young monk actually to be an abbot, maybe 10 vasa. And you know, he had been in the Korean War. He was a medic in the Navy. And he saw that a lot of the monks were, myself included, were very selfish in our aspiration to become enlightened. We were kind of guarding our own time in our own space and maybe being very judgmental and critical and opinionated. And so he called it the Jack system. And that he learned in the Army or in the Navy. And the Jack system was basically, I got my Jack. You got a problem, I don't care, I got my Jack. And that kind of selfishness, of course, is what the teachings on generosity, forgiveness, compassion, empathetic joy, morality, restraint on harming others, sensitivity and communication, da-da-da-da-da-da, that's all about that, that part of selfishness, that kind of gross part of selfishness that human beings can exhibit. And so, say, and a beautiful example is our three great sisters are feeding us, and Marion's organized the retreat, and so many other things. And these are beautiful examples of altruism and selflessness, and they're very very profound, very important to continually develop those aspects of our character. And I think for all of us, it's pretty self-evident that is important. And so to always keep that in mind, so that when in a Buddhist forum, when we are talking about meditation or we're talking about the analysis of mind that the Buddha presents to us, that's within that context. Because without a generous heart and kind of looking out for each other, it just becomes really very easily just intellectual, clever, private, don't bother me, I'm meditating. And the joke I always say, leave me alone, I'm doing metta practice. It's kind of classic. So, and that you can see that. I think we've all seen that, where sometimes we have a really kind of neat insight, or we have a period of quite lovely quietness, and then we get kind of greedy about that. And then we start to become alienated from others. Leave me alone, you know, I'll do my duty, get out of here, so on and so forth. And that's unfortunate, because that won't work, because it's still based on me getting something and owning it, keeping it. And as we know, anything you want to hold on changes, so you have to let go of it all, really. So this sort of what we call conventional reality or conventional truth is not to be dismissed. So sometimes you see like ultimate truth, I'll have that, thanks. The conventional stuff you guys do. But no, that's a foundation in the teachings on like paramitas, generosity. The last birth of the Buddha was dana parami. In the paramita list, the first parami is dana. So that generous heart, the heart which has empathy for others, the heart which isn't just kind of self-convoluted and self-concerned all the time, that's important. Because with that sense of generosity, you can approach your own challenges and difficulties in a generous way, in a compassionate way. Whereas a mind which is still bound by these kind of limited selfish views, then it can be quite harsh. The inner world can be quite harsh. You can be very judgmental and critical rather than generous to your own limitations, generous to your own difficulties, generous to your own karma. Morality, of course, just that willingness not to like write speech, you know, having a mood of wanting to dump on someone or not doing it, just not doing it, even though everything in you says, oh, this is an easy one, I could really dump on this person. You don't do it, and that brings a tremendous amount of self-respect and joy. And you just take like right speech. If you think all of us, the things we've said that we've regretted, oh. You know, if you're developing sensitivity, you know, you are opening, because in meditation we are becoming very sensitive, very open, you know, very, very open. And that openness, one drops in some kind of toxic speech towards someone else. So if you get it, you really feel that, don't you? So the kind of refinement of awareness becomes more and more conscious of our effect on others and the possibility of joy in that effect, that I can affect you by offering you something of worth and value and heart, and the other of just kind of shielding the mind and closing off and leaving me alone, I want to meditate, would be very unfortunate. So much to do there. There's always lots to do there. So in that sense of conventional reality, we have our diaries, we have our calendars, we have the things we need to do in the future, appointments we need to make. And that preoccupies the mind to a certain amount of time. We just have to think about life in a kind of chronological self way. What do I need to do tomorrow, and how am I going to achieve all of that? But on a retreat, we can actually put away a lot of that kind of conventional self identity. Because really, there, you know, you just have to show up. You kind of hardly need a watch. There's not much you can really miss. You can miss the meal. You don't want to do that. Miss your shower time. That'd be really bad. So it's a very simple format. Very simple format within which you can begin to practice much more attention to that second aspect of the teaching, which looks at life as stream of consciousness. And stream of consciousness is more where you take out the self-identity and you begin to look at the stream of consciousness as phenomena, mental phenomena, physical phenomena, emotional phenomena, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. So let's say if I start in a kind of reflective, meditative attitude, I start worrying about this new building that we're trying to get up, then as a meditator, looking at this other way, so liberating truth, vimutti satcha, I see worry as worry. I try to see that as a particular manifestation of consciousness. Whereas in the worldly realm, when I put my viradhammo hat on, and then I have to think, okay, builder, architect, gotta get these guys together, are we gonna have enough money, is this gonna work, are we going to get this up before winter? I need to think that way. That's important. But now on a retreat, we can look at those kinds of considerations, but now just a stream of consciousness. So it's not saying that you start a retreat, you're not gonna worry or think about your family or remember some resentful memory. It's still gonna happen. But now you just see memory as memory, planning as planning. And you see it more as energy forms, formations of thought, physical feelings that come through you. So this is important. So this is where This is the second way where we abandon selfishness. We abandon selfishness in, first of all, the conventional way by just trying to be good people. And the second way is where we begin to no longer take these events, phenomena of consciousness as personal problems or personal things. We try to see them as just feeling is feeling, thought is thought, body is body, memory is memory, emotion is emotion, just like that. And that's a big shift in human consciousness. So if I feel like, if you feel annoyed at that fan, I mean, I really like it, but let's say you're under it and you don't like the movement of the fan. Like conventionally, you could say, "Here, Dhammo, turn that fan off." You could ask me, and I'd say no. So you'd lose. Okay. And then you could sit there, and then you could feel resentment. I think, insensitive monk, he's got no compassion. I'm freezing here. I'm leaving the retreat. Now that would be what we would call that disgruntled. We would call that unhappiness. We would call that blame. And so then to see that, oh, this is the feeling of disappointment when I get what I don't want, or where I don't, when I get what I can't get what I want. That's a different mindset. The other mindset of blame, or blame myself, oh, I should just be able to handle this, it's not that cold. That's still taking it personally. So sometimes you need to do that. So you maybe complain to me, say, oh, okay, I didn't know you had pneumonia, we'll turn it off. But the other, to notice, like, just like with fairness condition, I feel annoyed. And just to know, oh, annoyance arises from a cause, and it's just that way, and then it ceases. You can see it as something. And then I'm watching stream of consciousness. I'm looking at my life in a different way. Both are true. You know, both are true. So on a retreat, that's the kind of thing we're emphasizing, because we have a chance to do that. We have this kind of interesting freedom where we don't have the freedom just to do what we want to do, say, because we have a sense of honor and we've surrendered to the format of a retreat. But we do have the freedom to watch, and that is what monasticism is based on. Monasticism is based on this kind of container, which is very well defined, and it's pretty tight. There's really not much options. And within that, we don't have the freedom. Like if I would like to sit junior to Venerable Subaru, can't do it. It's not in the cards. I'm senior to him, so I have to sit senior to him. So the, you know, it's a kind of fixed thing, fixed structure, fixed social structure. Food's very good here, but still, if I want yogurt in the evening, can't have it. And so on and so forth. So there isn't much physical freedom to do, come and go as we want to come and go. But they're very difficult, like a grown man having to ask the abbot, you know, can I go somewhere? Seems ridiculous. 30-year-old man has to ask permission to go out of the monastery. You know, it's quite hard for men. Quite a hard thing to do, because we're independent. You know, we're men. So there's a lot of kind of containment in monastic life. So there isn't the freedom that way, but there is the freedom to just watch. And that's a particular kind of freedom. It's a freedom to watch preference. It's freedom to watch liking and disliking. And not always just try to rearrange life to suit one's pleasure or to avoid one's pain, but to watch pleasure and pain, to watch like and dislike, to watch disappointment, inspiration, boredom, as conditions of mind coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And taking the kind of position of Buddha knowing Dharma. Oh, this is a Dharma of disappointment. Or this is a dharma of boredom, or this is a dharma of interest, or whatever it is, and see it coming and going, coming and going. And that's the attitude of watching stream of consciousness. So that's what I suggest we're doing on this retreat. We're not just trying to get focused and get our samadhi together and so on. It's much more profound than that, because a retreat is 24/7. But we're watching stream of consciousness. How does this environment affect you? How does what I say affect you? Or the person sitting next to you affect you? Or your memory system, how does that affect you? And most importantly, where does it take you? How does it grab you? What prevents you from abiding in the present moment in a peaceful way? Because logically, it's peaceful. You know, we're good people. We kind of know each other. We trust each other. It's a lovely, lovely environment. So why should you suffer? Right? It's not logical to suffer. And yet, something will happen. We will suffer. Probably physical pain, or we'll feel annoyed because someone's wearing a nylon jacket. Have you ever had that in meditation? Someone wears a nylon jacket next to you? It's very annoying. I had someone like that once. I couldn't fit in nylon. So every time they just shifted slightly, there was this rustling. So what's happening there? We're watching stream of consciousness. And so person A is sitting beside me, and they have this nylon jacket, and they let's say they're fidgety. So not only do they have a nylon jacket, but they shift a lot, and they're a very loud breather. There's a triple combination to really drive you crazy. So then you think, I can't do this. I need a peaceful environment. I'm leaving the retreat. Or you think, well, I'll go to the other end of the hall. There's not much room here. You can't get away. Right? So what happens? You have contact when you're hearing something. So whatever, I'm sitting here, nylon jacket, loud breathing, and restlessness. So that's contact. That's what's happening. You're getting audio contact. And then, because it's disturbing in the sense it keeps pulling you away from your object of meditation, it's annoying. Right? So the feeling is unpleasant. It's unpleasant. And then from that feeling of unpleasantness, what arises is the desire not to have the unpleasant. Go away. Why don't you just practice with the cows? Why did you ever come here? Take your jacket off. I'm leaving in retreat. Whatever. The desire arises, the desire to not have that. And then the thinking starts, isn't it? And the thinking becomes a kind of a self, as I was saying earlier, and that's what we call birth. Right? So this is a series of things which happens very quickly. It happens very, very quickly. And then what I do then each time I get contact with that unpleasant thing, the rustling, the deep breathing, the restlessness, becomes a kind of a sign, or a flavor, or a quality, and that quality keeps attracting me. And there are other qualities, but now my mind has entered into a kind of serious bit of aversion, and so sometimes the person isn't even in the room. Maybe I don't notice they didn't come for the sitting, and I'm waiting for it. Waiting for a kind of anticipating aversion. And then maybe I see the person in the hallway. I don't see the person anymore at all. I just see their nylon coat and my aversion. Maybe I project onto them that the person's a psychopath or whatever. I could create all kinds of things around that. And all it is sound. It's all it is just sound. But the sound has a particular quality to my stream of consciousness. It's a sound I don't want, so it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant. And so this pattern is something I would suggest that we really try to watch in this retreat. It's a very important pattern. It happens with the unpleasant, it happens with the pleasant. But say in that example, then what would you do? What would you do there? Well, obviously what you'd have to do is pay attention to contact. You'd have to be with sound consciousness. And you have to be really, you'd have to go towards that object that is annoying you. You'd have to go toward, you have to listen for it and just watch. Well, it's only sound. It's not like the person's a kind of chainsaw massacre, right? It's not immoral. We didn't do that, like ninth precept, thou shalt not wear a nylon jacket. But it's annoying. So you begin to just use that. You see, you use that very, very predicament to sharpen your awareness to contact, feeling, craving, attachment, and the sense of self. You try. And then if you really do that, you just pay attention, you find it becomes neutral, usually. Don't you find that? It just, you know, because it has no power. It only has power through inadvertence. So maybe I resist that. And just listen, listen. Listen, what is that? And that begins to give you the insight into dependent origination. The insight that with contact there is feeling. With feeling there is craving. With craving there's attachment. And with attachment there's becoming, birth, old age, sickness, and death. And again, birth in this sense is not in terms of like babies and people and birth and death like that. It's like a conscious creation, like a world of self. Because when I'm averse to that person, there's a kind of world that's born, isn't it? There's me and there's you, and there's, you know, you shouldn't be that way. This is birth. And if you stay attentive to contact, stay attentive to contact, you see, well, actually, you don't let it go into aversion. You don't let it go into birth. And that's the end of birth. You know, that's the cessation of birth and death. Right there, right there. Now, if you, in like I was suggesting with like physical feelings, if and you know, this is a very practical kind of teaching, but really do that, like sit down, and then, you know, meditating, usually you figure out a posture where you don't get any pain for some time. And then the first arising of discomfort, pain, or so on, really pay attention to that. What do you do with that? Do you immediately start to get nervous? Oh gosh, I'm never going to make it through the hour. Or, you know, should I move? But what, you know, that's very quick. But go right to the feeling of discomfort, not to get rid of it, not just to hold on to it, but see where does the sense of self arise? What is the craving? How does that work in your mind? It's a very good example. It's a very good example. Pleasant things also, like if you're creative. I know my mind likes to do projects and I like hobbies and things like that. So if I pick up a new project or a new hobby, then my mind will enjoy the entertainment value of a new hobby. And I'll start, you know, if I'm not careful, if not mindful, I can just spend hours building things and not move. Going on and on. But why is that? So what's going on there? Well, that's the pleasant. You know, so when you have like a really creative and neat idea, problem, like I like problem solving, maybe you kind of go back to it. Oh, yeah, if I do this and I do that, maybe a bit of this and bigger than that, and that's very entertaining. That's pleasant. You know, it can be quite pleasant, and so the mind can be engaged in that. So how does that work? Well, that the pleasant arises. Take something like lust is a more obvious example. Say when the eye sees an object which has kind of lustful quality to it, that's a kind of quality that the mind enjoys. It finds that entertaining. And so then away from that object, the mind can then bring that up, that quality or that sign, and then the mind starts to engage in how am I going to own that, or how can I be with that. It might be sexual fantasy, it might be romantic fantasy, whatever it might be. But it's a very pleasant thing. So then there's the attempt to keep the pleasant going, right? To kind of keep that going. But it's still a sense of self involved. So there's a different kind of a birth. And this kind of preoccupation with birth, with sense of self, prevents the mind from actually being quiet enough to realize the deathless. That preoccupation with self-sense in positive or negative means that consciousness is not available for anything deeper and more profound. So it might not be very harmful, you know, it's not immoral, but it is a kind of restlessness of mind that prevents the deepest insights and deepest peace to take place. So to actually train the mind to be very still and very silent for long periods of time, one has to understand that movement of pleasure and pain. That movement of pleasure and pain. You think about something like worry. Maybe you're anxious about your retirement. Maybe Maybe someone in your family had Alzheimer's and you're now 60 plus and you start to think, maybe I'll get Alzheimer's. Now that's possible. Certainly that's possible. Genetically it might be probable, right? And that's a sign. That's a quality of consciousness, is the thought of a future disaster. Yeah? And that comes up into the mind. And then what happens is that sign is unpleasant, and so the mind starts to worry about it. What am I going to do? Because that sort of alleviates the unpleasantness of it. Makes you feel a bit better. And all of us know how worry never gets you out of it. Worry begets more worry. And so the mind starts to think that way. Look at prejudices and biases. Let's say someone, let's say you meet me, you don't know me from Adam, and you meet me one day, and I've just had a really rough morning, and we did an all night sit, and I dropped some wood in my kuti and burned a hole in my carpet, and I've got the flu, and then you meet me. And I bite your head off, right? And then I go back to my kuti. And I might feel really regretful for that. Think, oh, gosh, that person just came. And I might feel really regretful. But maybe that's the only thing you've ever seen of me, the only quality you've ever seen. So then you go away thinking, what a creep. 40 years, this is what he's got. It's just, I mean, pathetic. And then from that, then, first of all, you tell all your neighbors. And then you say, Buddhism is terrible religion. Buddhism's awful religion. And the whole world is built from one perception. And then each time you see me, maybe you see me in Perth, right? There he is. There he goes. And what does that do? That creates self and other. It's another kind of self-creation, isn't it? There's me and there's you. And you're the creep. And I saw it, it's true. And you'll always be creepy, and leave me alone. Now, obviously, we have to be careful of, you know, if there are psychopaths wandering around and so on. But how we can create people. How we can, we can take an unfortunate coming together, and then we identify that person forever from one memory. And you don't know the person, you know, the person might have regret for it. Maybe you interpret it completely wrongly. But then whenever that person comes up, that's the person that did that. But now, where's the problem there in terms of liberation? Well, it creates a strong sense of self. Not only is it kind of destructive in society and limiting, but it creates a strong sense of self and other. And that's another level of self that we're trying to liberate from the mind, this whole sense of self and other. And that's the deepest level, that there's a self-functioning here and an objective world out there. And that's very hard to let go of that. Very hard to just begin to just know that this is just a feeling, this is just a memory. So to do that with someone who, you know, one is judged very, very strongly and then held to that, to come to that person and then see the arising of that judgment and to know, oh, that's a condition, and no longer just hold on to the quality of mind there and just, you know, that's just a memory, but who is this person? Who is that person? That's it's a mind which is liberated from that particular sense of self-identity. And, you know, if it happens 3 or 4 times, okay, there's some data, be careful, fine. Not to dismiss that. But so we see it. We see it in, right, racial biases and homophobia and all kinds of different biases that we have as human societies. And we might be PC, you know, we might be quite politically correct in the way we identify groups and so on, but we can still have, we hold these very strong self-identities. Self, maybe like, like from the conditioning of childhood, maybe our parents or some parents were cruel to us, and we have strong self-identities of shame or something like that. And where does that come from? It comes from a sign, some kind of identity. It comes up. So what we're trying to do is see the sense of self that arises in these different ways as simply an object. Okay, you know, it arises because of the causes and conditions. So sometimes it's a very something fascinated, something angry, something fearful, something whatever, and just see these are objects of mind in stream of consciousness. Now, as we start to do that, we start to see this, the conditioned nature of self. And the way I like to think on it, it's the, you know, your personality is weather rather than a thing. You think, you know, contemplate when you're in a good mood. It's more like weather, isn't it? And your personality manifests as good mood. But when you're in a bad mood, your personality manifests as dark clouds. But it's not really you; it's just weather. So as you can see, oh, this is weather. You're careful and so on. You can see, well, but I'm not really that weather. You know, there is this awareness, there is this knowing, there is this refuge, and you begin to disentangle. Or disengage from this awful clutching on to self views and self and other. So if in your life or on a retreat or whenever, if you really have strong self other identities, look at that. And if I really have a strong bias towards someone, against someone, whatever, really look at that and see that strong bias towards, like if you think someone is really great and you're lesser, look at that bias. Because that creates, you know, your adulation of someone creates you as a lesser being. Certainly you can say, oh, this person is more skilled in carpentry than I am, that's fine. But a kind of a lot of ego, self-adulation or self-disparagement or whatever, see that as just a condition. And you begin to see how the sense of self is created and born into the mind, but that there is behind that, there is awareness of change. And that's the liberation. Awareness of causality, awareness of conditionality, awareness of dependent origination. And that perspective is the perspective which we're not just believing in that. You know, it's not like I believe in dependent origination of change. We're applying that perception. You're introducing that perception as an interpretation. So say I have a really strong bias towards someone. I begin to say, well, that bias is a conditioned thing. It's an object of mind, it's a mood. And that sense of self that arises with it, that's a mood of the mind. That's a perception I have to bring into a kind of way of defining things. So it's very alive. You know, it's not a dead thing. You're like, if you believe in Buddhism, forget it. What's the point? You believe in Buddhism, and then what do you do with it? That's the thing, isn't it? So enacting Buddhism or doing Buddhism or cultivating perceptions that are skillful, this is a very conscious, active kind of practice rather than just a passive Buddhist position, you know, that I believe in Buddhism or so on. So may I suggest on this retreat, try to just stay with stream of consciousness as your mind starts to think about you know, where you're going and all that. If you can, just let go of that and just see, this is worry or this is planning. Try to get to the raw data, as it were, and then see how the sense of self arises. See how it comes up in positive or negative ways. See what the quality or the sign of mind that keeps triggering that. What makes that happen? Really get to know that causality, and then you're the witness of change, rather than the being the person who's always caught up in those changing qualities.